The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
This morning on Campus Voices, we have Professor Ricardo Patron from the University of Virginia, who's on campus giving a lecture. Welcome to us. What are you going to be talking about later today?
Well, thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to be talking about something that I've just finished writing a book that I hope will be coming out in print in the next year or two. The title is Remapping China, the Global Cartography of the Spanish Pacific. And it's about the ways that Spaniards imagined the Pacific and Asia in the wake of the encounter with the Americas. So, you know, in the 100 years after Columbus, basically, the way they thought of the Indies, as they always called it, is this trans-Pacific space that included both America and East and Southeast Asia.
And the reason that we've invited you to come speak at the University of Delaware is because we're tying in with an exhibition over at the Winterthur Museum that'll be running through January 8th of 2017 called Made in the Americas, The New World Discovers Asia. And you told us you'd seen this exhibition before.
Yeah, I saw it while it was at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, and it is absolutely wonderful and really kind of mind-blowing in a way. One of the pieces I most remember is this large tapestry that was made in Peru. I can't remember if it was in the 16th or 17th century, but they've hung it next to a Chinese tapestry so you can see how the Peruvian artists are taking their ideas and their motifs and the overall design of the piece from this Chinese tapestry. And you can see that there's this actual influence of Asian art, especially Chinese art and Japanese art, on Latin American art, both in Peru and in Mexico during, you know, the 17th and 18th centuries.
Now, before we started recording this interview, we were joking with each other about how we weren't taught about this connection between Spain and Asia through the Americas.
Yeah, that's right. It's something that has only started getting attention from scholars in the United States since roughly the late 80s. It's kind of taken off in the last 15 years or so. But yeah, you were saying you didn't learn this in high school. I didn't learn this in graduate school, you know, the idea of this connection. It's something that's really sort of emerged in the scholarship since the late 80s. It's taken off in the last 20 years. I mean, there's scholarship going back to like the 1930s, a really good book from the 30s. But this is really a new topic, the study of the early modern Pacific and the Spanish Pacific. In other words, the Pacific between, you know, roughly 1513 and the time in the 18th century when the English and the French start exploring.
We've been joined by Guillermina Gonzalez, the executive director of the Delaware Arts Alliance. And Guillermina, what about you? Were you taught about the trade from the Americas?
All the time. I have to say that my high school teaching was a private school. It implied that the level of globalization, sort of speak, was taught. So we were fully aware of what was going on.
Where were you raised?
Mexico City. Actually, comparison and contrast in between high school level in Mexico and high school level here in the U.S., I have to say that is far superior, the level in Mexico. Because they taught you, just to give you an idea, for instance, I was taught about Shakespeare in English. Mm-hmm. I was taught about how influential China was. What I wanted to say is that the level of education in Mexico in comparison to the U.S., I have to say that the one in Mexico is far superior. I don't know if, Ricardo, you have the same experience. I agree. But talking about this topic, it wouldn't surprise me if it's Mexico. There was a lot of commerce, traffic in between Spain and Philippines, and Mexico was very much part of this. My father, who grew up in Cuba, and my mom from Ecuador, they never learned about this in high school. At some point, the Huantepec Isthmus was an alternative to Panama Canal because of this traffic and commerce in between nations. Mexico was a point of contact, not only commercially speaking, but culturally speaking. Mexicans very fast learn all of these. One of the examples of Balbuena poem, for instance, Mexican greatness, one of the first important poems written in America. It's celebrating Mexico City. And certain parts of the poem celebrate Mexico as the point of contact in between Asia and how to connect with them commercially speaking. Mexico is the cultural capital in many ways of the New World. In the early 20s, the beginning of the century, Mexico was this cultural capital. It was Russian people, Cuban people were very welcome. What began back then in commerce or from commerce perspective made Mexico a cultural capital of the New World. It's about globalization, cultural globalization.
I was picking up from what you were talking about, that it sounded to me like, Guillermina, you were saying that having gone to school in Mexico City, you learned more about the early globalization than
correct.
I did going to school in America.
And we were very mindful about that. At some point, I don't really know the translation in English, the Istmo de Tehuantepec.
The Isthmus of Tehuantepec.
That was the alternative, so you know, of the Panama Canal.
Uh-huh. So this is a part of southern Mexico where the coastlines, the Atlantic and the Pacific coastlines get very close together.
Right. And so this is where the goods would go from one coast of Mexico to the other.
Correct.
Right.
To do this trading.
Right. Yes. But, you know, now that we're speaking about, canals, thinking about, putting a canal somewhere through Mexico or Central America goes back to the period that we're talking about. You know, I've seen a document from 1526 that talks about the possibility of connecting certain rivers in Panama. So you could sail up one river, go across the canal, and then sail down the rest of the river. And by the time this document is written, it's clear that the debate is already old, that people have already been talking about how can you create a waterway through Central America. But of course, it was just not at all technologically feasible in the 16th, 17th, or 18th centuries.
¿Por qué cartografía? O sea, ¿qué es lo que te llama de la cartografía? Why are you so interested in cartography? It wasn't globalization, but it was. Well, actually, it was globalization. The concept of globalization, as we know, it goes back to 15th, 16th centuries. It's a personal fascination that I've had since an early age. Graduate school, I realized that I was able to compare cartography with literature. And it was through the Peruvian literature that I realized that Juan Lombera, the great national novel, wrote the first cartography map in Peru. We cannot imagine spaces without including narrative. Space is always connected with history, even legends, real stories. But you need history to have a specific space and narrative to understand or have meaning. My work, it's always related to understand the relationship between cartography and literature.
So working with maps and studying maps gives you a window to see all sorts of different kinds of things about the relationships between people.
Because maps themselves are a kind of fiction. When you think about the idea that, I think we kind of take it for granted that we can see the Earth from up above. Because we're used to satellite photography, Google Earth, even like the pictures that the astronauts took from the moon. Yet in the 16th century, this was really very new. The idea that you could make this elaborate drawing that claimed to show you the Earth as it was from this godlike perspective.
So mapping a three-dimensional object to a two-dimensional piece of paper.
Right, yes. And the Middle Ages had their maps as well. But, this is something that I realized in my first book. But for example, the word in English, the word map, like the word mapa in Spanish, these words don't start circulating until the 16th century.
Really?
The Middle Ages has the word mapa mundi, which is used specifically for a particular type of depiction of the entire world. But there's no generic word for everything that we would call a map. And so these words start circulating. Mapa and mapa in Spanish and map in English start circulating in the 16th century at the same time that printed maps become readily available for the very first time. Mm-hmm. So this is a real revolution in the way people are looking at the world, that they can actually picture the world through the mediation of a map.
Right. Sounds like there are a lot of things that are coming together there in terms of the printing technology, knowledge of the world. I mean, before that, people knew about the world through seamen's journals. I mean, you know, captains writing things down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's still very important in the 16th century. A lot of times, early maps are actually derived from written texts. You take the whatever measurements the pilot might make during the voyage to determine the distances, but otherwise you're basing a lot of what you do on written descriptions. So there's a very close relationship between writing and the construction of maps in this early period.
Lo pregunto es a futuro mapas cartografía hacia dónde el pasado es importante pero de hacia dónde.
Bueno, es una muy buena pregunta porque claro,
today cartography has been totally transformed by digitalization. A friend of mine, for instance,
una amiga mía comentó que estaba en tráfico,
who works in traffic, saw that somebody was in the middle of traffic, saw somebody taking a map, and she realized that she had never seen somebody doing that. I don't know if we understand how digitalization, Google Maps, is changing the world and our relationship with the space. I've heard that we are transforming ourselves we are illiterate in terms of space, because as far as we depend on Google Maps and tells us go here, go there, we cannot actually conceptualize the space in the way we navigated the world. So that's the consequence. Our relationship with space is changing because the technology we use to conceive space is preventing us from understanding the world.
You and Guillermina were just talking about the future of map making. I want to go back to the 15th century, 16th century, 17th century.
Tell me what you want to know, Richard.
What I want to know is, how did these people figure out that it was shorter to go overland via Mexico, rather than going through the Straits of Magellan or around one of the capes?
Trial and error. Trial and error. And, one of the fascinating things about reading this is that, Columbus makes it across the Atlantic fairly easily. And people are frightened. It's new. I don't want to minimize what those people experienced. But, he right away discovers the route there and back again. And Columbus's route becomes more or less the route that the Spanish use throughout the early period.
Mm-hmm.
The Pacific absolutely defies this. Magellan is the first European to cross the Pacific, and he finds the way east to west right away. He finds out that if you sail to the equator, you're going to pick up the prevailing winds and currents that are going to carry you west. And he gets across the Pacific. The trip is much longer than he expected, but he gets across without any storms, without any incident. The problem is the return trip. And what you get is one Spanish expedition after the other. Once Magellan, once his ship, he doesn't make it, but once his ship makes it around the world, the Spanish decide that it is indeed feasible to cross what they called the South Sea and establish a colony on the western shores. And there are several attempts to do this, but they all fail because no one can find that return trip. In other words, they have to find a route, the winds and currents that will carry you back eastward across the Pacific. And everyone gets beaten back by storms, by sickness, by rough seas without managing to do it. And so it's not until 1565, this Augustinian friar who has one of the most interesting early modern lives, he's actually on one of the early expeditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
He gets sent to the Spice Islands in this follow-up expedition to the Magellan expedition. And he ends up in a 10-year guerrilla war with the Portuguese. And this is one of the most fascinating episodes.
Where?
It's all in what we call the Spice Islands, what, the part of Indonesia called Maluku, right? And basically the Portuguese and the Spanish are duking it out for the control of five small islands that produce cloves. And the Spanish have made an alliance with the Raja of one island. The Portuguese have made an alliance with the Raja of another island. And there is low-level warfare going on between the Spanish and the Portuguese for something like for 10 years trying to control this. And what happens is the Portuguese can get resupplied because they have good connections with Portuguese colonies in Malacca and in Goa, whereas the Spanish, you know, they're far away from New Spain. They can't get back across the Pacific. They're isolated from resupply. Eventually, they start dying out. Some of them ended up just sort of marrying into the local population. And finally, Charles V, the King of Spain, for reasons completely unrelated, signs a treaty with Portugal where he sells his rights to the Spice Islands. And then these guys get the news, you know, 2 years later, because that's how long it takes for the news to travel. They get the news 2 years later that a treaty has been signed, making the whole war irrelevant and giving the islands to Portugal. So Urdaneta is one of these people. So he ends up going back home on Portuguese ships. But by that point, he's gone all the way around the world. He ends up becoming an Augustinian friar, spending his life in Mexico City.
Right.
And Philip II, this is much later on, this is after another failed attempt, Philip II decides, okay, we're going to try again to colonize the Philippine Islands. And they know that Andrés de Urdaneta is the single person in all the Spanish-speaking world who best understands the Pacific. And he tells Philip II, no. You can't do this. Those islands are in Portuguese territory. But there's a lot of disagreement. You know, no one can measure longitude. So there's a lot of disagreement about how wide the Pacific is, whether the Philippines are actually in Portuguese territory or Spanish territory. Because one of the things we should remind readers is that, you know, Spain and Portugal had signed the Treaty of Tordesillas, where they split the world like an orange, they say, into two hemispheres. But if no one can measure longitude, no one can say for certain which side of the line these islands are. Urdaneta knew. He was right. And he told Philip II, no, you can't do it. Philip II chose to believe someone else who told him that the Pacific was much narrower than it was and that the Philippines were in Spanish territory. But so they get Urdaneta to go on the trip because they need his skills in locating the vessel, locating the islands. And it's not until they are out at sea and the captain opens his secret orders that Urdaneta finds out that they're going to colonize the Philippines, that they're going precisely to the islands that Urdaneta had told the king.
Don't do it.
Yeah, so he totally gets conned into doing it. So they make it to the Philippines. The captain, Legazpi, stays to establish a Spanish colony, and it's Urdaneta's job to discover that return route. And he manages to do it. I think it's something like 5 or 6 months to get back. And by the time the ship is pulling into Acapulco, everyone is so sick and so debilitated from hunger and from thirst that no one can really manage it. They have to send a boat out from the port to sort of steer them in. So they barely make it alive. But Urdaneta has kept careful records on the whole trip. And what they say is that he was able to sit down with a chart and annotate it in detail so that the route he discovered became the route that was used for this trans-Pacific trade that emerged, really thanks to this guy's accomplishment, thanks to Urdaneta's accomplishment.
So you're just talking about 5 to 6 months to get from the Philippines back to Mexico.
It took about 3 months to get from Acapulco to Manila and somewhere around 5 months to get from Manila to Acapulco. Yeah. You had to do a big arc. You had to sail from the Philippines along the coast of Japan. And once you were north of Japan, then you could turn east and could be confident of finding winds and currents that would take you back towards California.
It's also a combination with mathematics. They were making such calculations. Números. Really, it's numbers, trigonometry, mathematics, making calculation, longitude. It was possible to measure latitude without any difficulties, but longitude was difficult, very extremely difficult to define. So you need to estimate the distance, how long have you traveled, and then translate that into longitude in terms of mapping. But it's an estimate. It's always an estimate. With tons of errors, by the way. Spanish consistently didn't calculate like 30%. They missed like 30% of the measurement. Enough for these kind of islands that are on the other side of this separation go to Spain, for instance. 30% is enough to miss the mark in terms of the Spanish maps, because Philippines, Indonesia are established on the Spanish side, but China, Vietnam, Spanish people thought that that was Spanish territory, not Portuguese territory.
That's all those different places.
Yeah.
Just so, for a little mistake.
The time that you studied, Ricardo, and the maps that people would make, they didn't have accurate enough timepieces to have longitude.
No, no. It's
like they're doing calculations on guesswork.
Yeah. You know, when this expedition, the one that Urdaneta and Legazpi is on, they make landfall in like Guam, or if not Guam, at least one of the islands near Guam. And there is debate about whether they're in the Philippines or not. And, you know, and I'll invite listeners, you know, open up Google Maps, look for Guam, look for Manila,
right.
Look at the distance. No one could tell. Urdaneta knew that they were not in the Philippines. He had an accurate sense of how wide the Pacific was.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy who was in charge of the expedition, the guy who had told Philip II,
right.
Thought he was in the Philippines.
It's like us talking about sending a mission to Mars.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
It was about the same experience.
Yeah.
The unknown, precisely.
You're probably safer going to the moon than you were going to the Spice Islands. I mean, death rates on these ships could be as much as 50%. And the absolute misery of life on board a 16th century sailing vessel. I mean, when you think of, you know, people in the 16th century, they lived dirtier lives. You know, they were much closer to nature. They weren't showering every day. So even by the standards of the time, which are a lot less hygienic than ours are today, they complain about how filthy and how horrible the ships are.
Can you imagine that?
Horrible, ¿no? Yo no me lo imagino.
Y puros hombres en estos barcos.
No siempre. En una de estas expediciones.
In one of these expeditions, and this is the one that I really, really gets my attention. It was for 1542, when the Philippines were about to be colonized, they cannot find the route back home, and almost everybody dies. We know that half, based on documents, were European, Spanish, but also Portuguese from Spain, I mean from Italy. But the other half were Indian people and Indian women. There were women, indigenous women, that spoke the native language. We can imagine that it was a small cosmopolitan little place on top of these ships. It was globalization at its best in small boundaries. Just imagine indigenous people from Spain. It was what do they speak? Castilian, like old Spanish, and a combination of a little bit of everything, but essentially Castilian. I don't really know. To be honest, I don't really know. If I were a writer, I'll write something about that kind of expedition, because trying to imagine this cultural contact in a very small space in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and then they reached Philippines, they tried to colonize and a Latin American colony, a combination of various peoples and creating a Spanish stronghold.
Did these people going on these trips know how bad the conditions were going to be?
Yes, they did. And it was often very difficult to recruit sailors. There was a lot of lying that went on. You know, you wouldn't find out until you were at sea just how far the vessel was going. And, you know, throughout, you know, what's called the Age of Sail, European vessels depended on impressing people or coercing people to man these vessels. Now, on the other hand, there were people who were willing to take these risks because the potential payoff was enormous. One of my favorite historians says that, you know, you have to think of conquistadores as gamblers. They're taking enormous risks, putting their lives at stake, putting their fortunes at stake, precisely because the possibility that you could really strike it rich is enormous. And this may also explain a lot of the cruelty that they're willing to engage in, because, you know, they're far from home, they've risked it all, they're in sort of disparate situations. I don't want to idealize these people. You know, it becomes a lot more understandable how some conquistadores could do what they did when you understand the kind of extreme thinking and the extreme situations they're getting into.
What were some of the big things? What were some of the little things that have gone back and forth as a result of this early trade in the 16th century?
Well, you know, one of the biggest results of this trade is that the Philippines is a largely Catholic country. One of the things that travels on the Manila galleons, as they were called, is the colonial power, Spanish colonial power as exerted over the Philippines. American silver is the big commodity that is traveling westward. That's what's being used to buy Chinese silk and porcelain and things, things like this. China is, the Chinese economy is just absolutely starved for precious metals, especially for silk. About half the silver produced in the world between 1500 and 1800 ends up in China. And a lot of it goes over the Pacific. But there's also movement in the other direction. And one of the movements is of people. When we look at early Mexican history, and by early Mexican, I mean colonial history, in other words, the 16th, 17th centuries, we start seeing the presence of what the documents refer to as chinos or indios chinos. And there's debate about what these people are, because chino in Mexico, but I mean, sometimes now, but then certainly was used kind of generically to talk about Asians. So we don't know if they're talking about Chinese people, about Japanese maybe, probably Filipinos. And what we know is that Asians of various descriptions, but probably mostly Filipinos, were making their way east as well. We get the first Asian American communities in the 17th century, and Mexico City has what we might call America's first Chinatown. And the chinos of Mexico City have their own religious confraternity. They have their own processions. They have their own sort of civic presence in the life of Mexico City. There's Asian slavery. There are enslaved Filipinos. There's a wonderful book about that recently by my friend Tatiana Sejas. And then art. You know, a lot of the silver is being used to buy luxury goods. And so, for example, something I learned from an art historian friend, Dana Leibson, is that Mexico made its own silk. They also imported silk from Spain. But the range of colors was very limited. And so Chinese silk, that's where you would get things like bright orange and bright yellow and bright red. A lot of this silk would go into luxurious homes or into decorating churches, altarpieces and things like that. And so whenever in colonial Mexico you're looking at bright colored silk, you're looking at something of Chinese origin. This Chinese and Japanese artistic influence really penetrates the life of colonial Mexico and of colonial Peru, especially when we think of it, you know, that it's in the churches and therefore it's being seen by everyone and not just by wealthy consumers.
We need to talk about chocolate. We have to talk about chocolate. One of the things that Mexico gave to the world, among other things. I love chocolate. I do love chocolate. It's part of this trade, de este comercio.
People would fight over the good chocolate all over Europe.
And it's one of the things that Mexico gave to the world.
See? La introducción del chocolate,
the introduction of Mexico to chocolate and tobacco that come from all over other parts of Latin America, coffee that comes from Colombia, Puerto Rico, and the south part of Mexico, and we need to reflect that in cartography, all the many things that Latin America has given to the world. But let's go back to chocolate. I always tell my students that something very American, like the brownie, for instance, cannot be explained before globalization of 16th century. We have flour that comes from Europeans, sugar that is brought to the world from Middle East and Africa. Sugar belongs to Asia, and then, of course, chocolate that is has Mexican origin. A brownie cannot be conceived before 1542. Chocolate, as we know, has to include milk and sugar. Consumption in Mexico before that is essentially with water. And it's completely different. The consumption is different as we know chocolate these days.
Thank you so much, Ricardo.
Muchísimas gracias.
De nada, un placer. Gracias a ustedes.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark. or online at wvud.org.